We're going to talk today about serving. And before we get into some of the text we're going to be looking at, I want to share with you a story about serving. So it is 2018, right? And so about 13 years ago, it was my first month of being a vocational minister. So meaning that I had my first full-time job in ministry. I wasn't working two jobs, but I was dedicated to ministry. I was a youth pastor at this church. And on that first month of ministry at our old location on Market and Lancaster, there was a ditch that ran alongside the east side of our property. If you remember that property, you know that ditch well. And about two times a year, inmate work crews would come and work on this particular ditch to take out grocery carts and unbelievable amount of trash that was down there. But take out trash and garbage and take out weeds and trees that were growing there that should not be, and clear the ditch so that way there would be a clear path to protect the community from flooding. And I can remember on this first month of full-time vocational ministry, driving into the parking lot that day during a weekday for work, and I noticed these poor inmates having to work outside. And little did I know then that's like a great privilege for them. And so I felt compassion in my heart for these inmates clearing out the ditch. And because I was so holy and because I was such an amazing Christian, I wanted to make sure that I spent this first month of full-time ministry well doing the Lord's work. And so I immediately left the parking lot and I drove over to Fred Meyer, and with my own money, because I'm such a holy, righteous, religious, wonderful person, I bought as many cans of soda that I could carry. And I bought Mountain Dew and Pepsi and Diet Pepsi and Dr. Pepper and root beer and Sierra Mist because I wanted to make sure these guys had a choice. And so I bought all these cans of soda and I bought the largest foam cooler that I could find. And I bought a big bag of ice and I dumped all the ice into this foam cooler. I loaded the soda up. I made sure I bought it cold. And I even got cups to bring to them. And I brought chips. And I actually, before I went, I did go and I asked the corrections officer if I could do this. And he was like, I guess so. And so I brought those things, drove them back to the church. And I was so proud. And I was in such a moment of greatness and self-exaltation because I knew I was such a holy, amazing, righteous Christian that with about 20 inmates in front of me, they see me driving up and I grab the big foam cooler filled with ice and filled with soda and I proceed to start to walk over to these inmates that I was going to bless them. I was going to lead all of them to Jesus with this soda that I was bringing, and a revival would ignite and start back in the prison system over my delivery of soda. And I was so pumped up, and I knew I was going to get like a deal to go in and preach to these inmates every week, and I would have an international prison ministry all because it started with these cans of pop. And so I picked up the foam cooler and started to walk over to the inmates. And right as I was about 5 feet from the first inmate, they were all of them literally gathered. The corrections officer was like, gather in, guys. You know, he's got pop for you. And they're like, oh, we've never seen such a Jesus-like action in all of our life. And as I'm moving closer and closer to them, the foam cooler is not able to support the weight of all the ice and all the soda. And it just splits in two. And in slow motion, Matrix style, the cans of soda just started slowly falling to the ground. And there was not grass beneath my feet. There was not pavement beneath my feet. But there was sharp, jagged gravel in the parking lot. And because these soda cans were inside of this foam cooler and getting jostled around inside of my car, and because it was a hot day and there was a lot of stuff working against the contents of these cans, as they fell, they hit the gravel, and with God as my witness, because God is still laughing to this day, like 20 of these cans, they didn't just break and start leaking, but they exploded. And I was just stunned and shocked and frozen in horror, and I'm looking down as all of these soda cans in slow motion are falling, hitting the gravel, and no joke, the root beer, it got the world's smallest hole inside, and there was the most pressure ever contained inside of a small object before creation. And it was like, psss, right into my eye. with the most pressure you could imagine root beer having into my eyeball, and I couldn't move. I was stunned. I was shocked. I was embarrassed. I was mortified. The prison revival had just been ruined, and I just stood there with root beer running into my eye. And so what did I do at, how old was I, like 27 years old or 26 years old? Did I brush off and say, brothers, come to me. Let us drink together. I just ran away as quick as I could. And I just threw the soda there. And I did not go outside until those guys left. And I did not go back to the church for a couple days because I knew they'd be coming back. And so that brings me to one of our DNA statements here as a church, and it's this. If you're saved, you serve. And I wish this story was made up, but it really, that was all true. If you're saved, you serve. And what we say here at Fellowship Church about that is that we are not consumers. But everyone contributes with time, treasure, and talent to kingdom growth. And so oftentimes in the West, we think that we come to a church service to be served and we're going to consume. But instead, we understand as Christians that if you are saved by Jesus Christ, you serve because Jesus said he did not come to be served, but he came to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. And so let's open up to Mark chapter 10. And in Mark chapter 10, we're going to read the account where Jesus actually says that. Jesus is continuing his final ascent, his final journey to Jerusalem. He's approaching what we call Palm Sunday. He's going in to the city for the final time. He's got a big crowd of people gathering with him, walking with him to the city, as we looked at back on Palm Sunday. And in verse 32, it says, and they, this is the people following Jesus, there likely were hundreds, if not thousands, they were on the road going up to Jerusalem, and Jesus was walking ahead of them, and they were amazed, and those who followed were afraid. Pay attention to that. They were amazed and afraid. So he's on his way. Jesus several times had been telling his followers, telling his disciples that he would go to the city of Jerusalem, that he would be betrayed, arrested, suffer, and die, and rise again. And many were following Jesus, not just because of the miracles he was performing and not just because of the teachings that he was teaching, but many people were following Jesus because they thought he was a political Messiah. They thought that he would go into the city of Jerusalem and eradicate the Roman occupation of Jerusalem, and he would become this Davidic king who would reign in this new kingdom of Israel throughout the entire earth, and that those who followed him might have something to do with that. And so as they're going up into Jerusalem, they're understanding that because they think Jesus is a political Messiah, that means that there might be a battle that would ensue shortly. And that means that they might have to take up arms and fight Rome and maybe fight some of even the religious leaders in Jerusalem. And so they were amazed at what Jesus was doing, but they were also afraid. They were afraid of what the implications of this may be. And before we continue, if I'm being totally transparent with you, I too am amazed and afraid of following Jesus. I'm amazed at how good God is and what he has done in my life, in me and to me and through me. But I am also afraid because Jesus has taken me some places I didn't want to go. I am also afraid because I never know what's around the next corner as I follow Jesus. But as I am afraid and amazed, I know that he leads me in paths of righteousness for his name's sake. And I know that even when I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil because he is with me. And so I think there is a very holy and healthy tension between being amazed and afraid. And so in verse 32, it says, taking the 12, so there were hundreds, maybe thousands, he pulls the 12 aside and he began to tell them what was going to happen to him again. See, we are going to Jerusalem, and I will be delivered over to the chief priest and to the scribes, and they will condemn me to death and deliver me over to the Gentiles. And they will mock me, and they will spit on me, and they will flog me, and they will kill me. And after 3 days, I will rise again. So in case you're forgetting, this is what I'm getting myself into. And dear disciples, if you want to back out because you're amazed and afraid, if you want to back out, now is the time. I'm going to be killed. I'm going to be beaten. I'm going to be mocked. I'm going to be betrayed. I'm going to be crucified. I'm going to suffer greatly. I'm going to rise again. And so if you want to back out, now is the time to back out. And so if you're a disciple, you've got to be thinking, how do we even respond to this? Now, you could argue with Jesus, but that didn't work out for Peter about a year and a half earlier, where Peter said, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God, and Jesus affirms that, and Jesus then tells him that he is going to die this brutal death, and Peter basically says, no, that's never going to happen, and Jesus looked at Peter and said, get behind me, Satan, and so they're not going to argue. They could definitely back out if they wanted to. They could ask some very relevant questions about what was going to happen in Jerusalem and what they were getting themselves into because they had absolutely no clue. Or they could just keep following and trusting, which is kind of what they did. But human nature has a way of getting in the way of what God wants us to do, doesn't it? Human nature has a way of confusing us a little bit. And so they could have done all these things, but instead, in verse 35, when things look like they're about to get difficult, James and John do something really weird. Now, it's usually Peter is the one who says the dumb things, but here it's James and John. And so James and John, remember, they're brothers, and it says in verse 35, James and John, the sons of Zebedee, that's their father. We're going to learn here in a moment, their mother is involved in this too. James and John, the sons of Zebedee, they came up to Jesus and said to him, teacher, we want you to do for us whatever we ask of you. Don't they know who they're talking to? Haven't they seen some crazy stuff the last 2 to 3 years? And here they're making demands of Jesus. They're treating Jesus actually like a genie. And we might think, oh, that's so dumb. We don't do that. But don't we do this all the time? Where God has actually called us not to make demands of him and to tell him what we want and to tell him what to do, but instead, God has actually asked us to pray according to his will. But they're not praying or asking Jesus according to his will. They actually say, we want you to do for us whatever we tell you to do. And what makes this account even crazier, not just that James and John have the audacity to ask this question, but Matthew records something different about this story, that it's actually their mom that asks this for them. If it wasn't pathetic enough that James and John asked this, their mommy makes this request for her boys, and this makes this demand and this request even that much more pathetic. So their mom asks. And so I love that Jesus plays into our stupid questions sometimes. Jesus plays into our stupid questions, I think sometimes to show us just how stupid we are, because that really is how Jesus works in a loving, gracious, holy, God-like way. And he says this, what do you want me to do for you? You want me to do whatever I ask, well, what do you want me to do? And I don't think James and John expected this. And so I can imagine James and John looking at each other and looking at their mom like, Mama, is that what he said? And I can imagine them shaking their heads and saying, proceed, Jesus. You know, you want us to tell you whatever we want you to do. And he says, what are you asking? They're like, okay, proceed. Let's get into our actual request. And they said to Jesus, grant us to sit one at your right hand and one at your left hand in glory. We want to sit on both sides of your throne, James and John, the sons of thunder, who our mommy asked questions for. We want to sit on both sides of your throne. So once again, they say, when you come into your glory, this is what we want this to be. And they're seeing this glory as a political Messiah. They thought, once again, that once Jesus set up a new kingdom in Israel, he would then make Jerusalem its capital. He would sit on the throne of David, and he would appoint a cabinet to rule under his authority. Now, before we continue, I read this several times this week, and I just don't understand if James and John actually believed that Jesus was going to die. I don't think they did. And if they, for some reason, did believe he was going to die, which the evidence does not suggest that, they must have thought that he would have resurrected immediately and started this new kingdom, eradicating Rome and installing this new Israelite government. Now, another thing that's interesting to see here is that via their mom, they're asking Jesus if when that happens, When this happens, when your new kingdom is established, can we be the top dogs? Can we be the man? Can we be the boss? Can we sit at your right and your left hand? We want to have the most prestigious spots in your cabinet. Now again, not only do we not know if they knew Jesus was going to die or not, if for some reason they knew Jesus was going to die, they had no idea this was going to be a long, drawn-out thing. Because I don't know if you know, but Jesus lived and died and rose again and ascended to the Father 2,000 years ago. And I don't believe James and John, if for some radical reason, if they didn't know that this was going to be an instantaneous kingdom birth of Israel over planet Earth, even if for some reason they thought that, either way, at that point, they are asking for the most prestigious spots in heaven. Either way, this is a pretty audacious request. Not to mention, this is a really stupid request. This is a very self-centered request to the creator of the very universe. So last week, we studied the account of someone known as the rich young ruler. And the rich young ruler, we studied that he wanted money, he wanted wealth, he wanted possessions. And when Jesus called him to give those things up, he could not do it. But here, James and John, they don't want money, wealth, and possessions. What James and John want is that these guys want status. These guys want recognition. These guys want authority. And these guys want greatness. So if you're taking notes on your phone or if you have a pen and paper, I want you to write down the question, want to be great? Or you want to be great? Do you want to be great? They want greatness. And so with this crazy, stupid question, how would Jesus actually respond? How would Jesus respond to what it was that they were actually asking for? And we find in verse 38, Jesus says, you don't know what you're asking, which they clearly did not. He says, you don't know what you're asking. Are you able to drink the cup that I drink? Are you able to be baptized with the baptism with which I am baptized? Again, they've got no idea what Jesus is saying. But what Jesus is saying is there would be glory to come. Can we sit on your right and your left hand when you come into glory? There would be glory, as we just discussed. But the only way to get to that glory was through something that we don't ever think is the way to glory. The only way to get to glory was through suffering. Suffering that only Jesus could and would endure. He just foretold it, didn't he? He said, I'm going to suffer and die. And he says, can you drink this cup? What Jesus is saying is, I'm going to have to drink the cup of my Father's wrath. We know, according to the rest of the Bible, that Jesus Christ, God the Son, would take on the entirety of God's wrath for the sins of mankind upon himself. He would drink the cup of God's wrath. We also understand where Jesus says, can you be baptized like I'm being baptized? And that was a very foreign concept. But what Jesus is saying is, can you be baptized in? Can you be submersed in the suffering of the mockery, the betrayal, and the crucifixion that I am about to endure? But since Jesus has yet to go through this suffering, to ask Jesus if you can be top dog in his kingdom before he has even suffered, it's pretty insensitive. The disciples clearly have no idea what's going on at this point. And they must have thought the path to glory would be very easy, but Jesus says, no, the path to glory will require suffering. And these disciples, they thought that the path to glory, they thought that the path to greatness was through self-importance. They thought it was through self-exaltation. They thought it was through making yourself prominent over other people. These two guys, James and John and their mom, they wanted greatness, and so they were going to ask Jesus for it. So when Jesus asks if they're able to drink the same cup and to be baptized in the same baptism, he says, you guys don't know what you're talking about. Are you able to do this? And what did they say in verse 39? They said, yeah, we're able. We can do it. We can drink the cup. We can be baptized in the same baptism, not having any idea what Jesus was saying. They thought this was going to be a quick one-and-done mission once they entered into Jerusalem. They thought that maybe they would have to stand by Jesus while Jesus suffered. Maybe they might even have to fight besides Jesus against the Roman Empire, because Jesus was going to ride into town victoriously and whoop Rome into shape is what they thought. But little did they know that Jesus was actually going to ride into town on a donkey. They didn't get it. And so Jesus is going to help them get it, going to help them understand. And so in verse 39, Jesus says to them, "The cup that I drink, you will drink. And with the baptism with which I am baptized, you too will be baptized." Now this is a little bit misleading, because we already learned that Jesus alone could experience such suffering. That only Jesus alone would create a path to God's glory through his death and his resurrection in this life. So Jesus here, he is not indicating that James and John's suffering, their personal suffering, will make a way to glory. And Jesus by no means is saying that James and John can earn their salvation through their own suffering. But what Jesus is doing here is Jesus is actually letting them know that, yeah, you guys will experience suffering. You will suffer for my name's sake. Because little did James know, and little did John know, that James, within a year, he would actually be executed by a sword for following Jesus. Little did John know that over the course of several decades, he would actually be boiled alive in oil in front of thousands of people inside of an arena and live to tell the story. Little did John know that he would be exiled to an island called Patmos, where he would spend many years there writing the book of Revelation. Little did John know that he would travel and suffer and preach the gospel for decades and die a very old man after a life full of suffering. So Jesus, by him saying this, by him saying, hey, you guys will suffer, Jesus is actually saying, even though you don't get it now, you will get it one day. And you'll get it so much that you will be willing to suffer for my name's sake. Now, the suffering would not be a way for salvation to James and John, but when James and John suffered, that suffering would actually bring them joy, as 1 Peter 4 says. James and John's suffering would bring them joy because they would be reminded of the glory to come in Christ. James and John would actually experience joy through their suffering because they would understand that they could reach more for the gospel through their suffering and the testimony that it would bring. And you see, each and every one of us will suffer in this life. Each and every one of us must suffer in this life. And if you're following Jesus, I'm just telling you, you will suffer more than someone who doesn't follow Jesus in this life. And if you're not suffering as a follower of Jesus, it's possible you're not following Jesus, because when you follow Jesus, you are going in the opposite direction of our enemy. And when you go in the opposite direction of your enemy, you stand opposed to your enemy. But maybe if you're not careful, you could be walking in the same direction as your enemy, and that's why you're not actually experiencing any opposition or any suffering. But when we do suffer for the sake of Christ, we are to consider it joy because it reminds us of the glory to come. And through that suffering, we can reach more for Jesus through the suffering and the testimony it can bring. So following Jesus telling these guys, hey, you're going to suffer one day, Jesus gets back to the question. This next year, I've been kicking around this idea of having a message series called Q&A with Jesus, because as we mentioned before, Jesus rarely ever answers questions in a conventional way. Jesus almost always answers questions in a very frustrating way that actually brings about a better answer than what they're seeking. And so he gets back to the question, and remember the question was this: when your glory is here, they didn't know what that meant. Can we sit on your right hand and on your left hand? And Jesus says this in verse 40. To sit at my right hand or at my left, it's not mine to grant. It's for those for whom it's been prepared. And so even though Jesus is God the Son in the flesh, there is actually a hierarchy within the Trinity, within the Godhead. That God the Son, Jesus Christ, submits to the will of God the Father. Though they are both co-equally and co-eternally God, the Son submits to the will of the Father. And Jesus is saying, because I submit to the Father, that's for him to decide who sits at my right and who sits at my left. Now, this is a very strange thing for Jesus to say here because it does not seem relevant. But here's a little bit better of a way for us in English and modern day vernacular to understand what Jesus is actually saying here. He's saying this: it doesn't matter. It's not for me to decide. My Father will decide who sits at my right hand and who sits at my left. It doesn't really matter. You might say, what are you talking about, Anthony? Here's what I'm talking about. What does matter is that Jesus will be the one on the throne. That's what matters. What does matter is that God is going to be the one to get all the glory. It doesn't matter who's sitting on the right or the left hand. What matters is that Jesus is going to be in the middle, right? What matters is that God gets the actual glory. James and John should not be concerned with the proximity of glory that they're going to sit next to. James and John should only be concerned that God gets the glory alone, and that the only way for this glory that they would experience to be experienced was through the sufferings of Jesus Christ. And so what were James and John ultimately concerned with? They were concerned with their glory. They were concerned with themselves, and they were concerned with their own greatness. Do you want to be great? They were concerned with being great. You see, what they needed to be concerned with was not themselves and their glory. They needed to be concerned with Jesus Christ in his glory. They were trying to exalt themselves when instead they should have been exalting Jesus, because the Bible tells us in James that God actually exalts those who are humble, and he humbles those who are actually proud. And so with this in mind, with the mind of James and John, when earlier when I said, man, how dumb were they for saying, Jesus, we want you to do whatever we tell you to do, in recognizing that we do that ourselves, I want you to actually stop and consider for a minute. If James and John were concerned about themselves and then glory, I want you to think about heaven for just a second. When you think about heaven, when you think about the new heaven and the new earth, when you think about where your soul goes when you die, and one day when your resurrected body lives on this earth with Jesus, when you think about that, what do you think about? Because a lot of times we think about us. We think about ourselves. How great will heaven be for me? Now, I can stand here and say, yeah, heaven's going to be amazing. It's going to be fantastic. But we need to be careful that we do not become like James and John and only think about ourselves. What we should be concerned with is that Jesus is in heaven, and that Jesus is on the throne, and that Jesus is reigning and ruling. It's not how great will heaven be for me, but instead how great will it be that Jesus will be there and that I have the opportunity to experience him. So in Mark chapter 10, verse 41, it says this. It says, when the other 10 heard it, they began to become indignant. We used that word a couple weeks ago. They began to be indignant. They were annoyed with injustice, and they were indignant at James and John. Now, you have to wonder, why are they mad? Why are they frustrated? Why are they annoyed with James and John? There's two options. The first option is this, is that they're thinking, man, James and John, you're so stupid for asking that. I don't think that's why they're indignant. I think they're indignant because they didn't think to ask it first. Like, oh man, why couldn't we have got there sooner? Andrew and Peter, like, James and John, dang it, sons of thunder, beat us again. We wanted to be the ones to ask it. And I think that they are frustrated they didn't think of this first. And so now we're going to get into the actual message that Jesus wants us to know. James and John want greatness. They're not thinking about Jesus. They're thinking about themselves. Jesus says, you're going to be able to drink this cup and be baptized like me? They say, yeah, we will. And Jesus said, okay, you will experience suffering, but it's up to the Father to decide how this is all going to be divvied up. And he says in verse 42, in 43, Jesus called them to him, like, hey guys, come in close. And he said to them, You know that those who are considered rulers of the Gentiles, they lord it over others. And the great ones, their great ones, exercise authority over them. Verse 43. But it shall not be so among you. You know that the worldly leaders, they love to lord their authority over people. They love to be the man. They love to be top dog. They love to boss people around. They love to enslave people. They love to give commands to people. They love to make demands like you just made of me, but it will not be so with you. James and John were not thinking kingdom-minded. They were thinking like the world. They want to lord over people. They want to exercise authority over others. But that is not how Jesus' disciples are to think or to act. It won't be so with you. Jesus says that true greatness is not found through lording over other people. You see, the world considers this greatness. If you want to be great, you lead people. If you want to be great, you boss people around. If you want to be great, you become the top dog. If you want to be great, you exercise authority over people. But Jesus says, no, 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 not in my kingdom. True greatness is not found in lording over other people. True greatness is found in something else completely different, something else entirely. True greatness is not found in ruling. True greatness is found in serving. Last two verses. He says in verse 43, whoever would be great. Whoever would be great. The world thinks that greatness is ruling. You think that greatness is sitting at my right hand and my left in glory. But listen up, disciples. Whoever wants to be great among you needs to become your servant. Whoever wants to be first, you guys want to be first. The other disciples, you're mad that you didn't think of this first. Whoever really wants to be first needs to become a slave. For even the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many. James and John, they want to achieve greatness and glory by being top dog. They want to achieve greatness and glory by being in charge. They want to receive greatness and glory by having authority. They want to receive greatness and glory by being the man. But Jesus says, you want to be great? You really want to be great? Serve. You want to experience greatness? Give your life. You really want to be great? Serve. I didn't come to be served. I came to serve. I didn't come to get anything, Jesus says. He says, I came to give everything. Jesus says, the Bible says in Acts 20, quoting something that Jesus says that's not in the Gospels, it's better to give. It's more blessed to give than to receive. You want to feel great? Serve. You want to have a great life? Serve. You want to find true glory? Serve. You want to find your highest purpose? You want to find the reason you were put on this earth? Do you want to discover the thing you were born for? Here's what you need to do. Serve. Greatness? Glory? Joy? It's not found through getting. It's not found through being served. It is found through giving, and it is found through serving. So do you want to be like Jesus? I asked you that a couple weeks ago. We often say, I want to be like Jesus. What do I need to do to be like Jesus? Jesus says, become like one of these children. You want to be like Jesus? Humble yourself. You want to be like Jesus? Have the faith of a child. You want to be like Jesus? Receive his kingdom like a child. But here Jesus is telling us, if you really want to be like me, if you want to be like me, this is what I want you to do. And sometimes when I say, I want to be like Jesus, what I'm actually saying is I want Jesus' power. I want Jesus' greatness. I want Jesus' authority. I want Jesus' fame. I want Jesus' glory. But what we're supposed to be saying is, I want to serve. I want to give my life, because if I want to be like Jesus, that's our chief aim as a follower of Jesus, is to be like him. If we want to be like Jesus, we must give and we must serve. Last week in the rich young ruler, that's why he went away sorrowful. He wanted to get and he wanted to be served. Because he was not willing to give and because he was not willing to serve, he went away sorrowful. But if we want to be like Jesus, if we want to embrace this Jesus kind of life, if we want to receive his kingdom, if we want to have kingdom-minded thoughts, we've got to serve. We've got to give. Because serving and giving, do you know what that is? Here's where we wrap this up. Do you know what serving and giving is? Serving and giving is love. That's what it is. What is love? It's serving and giving. In fact, the Bible says in 1 John 4:8, God is love. And if Jesus said, I didn't come to be served, I came to serve and to give my life. And if God is love, serving and giving is love. And you can't love without serving. It's not possible. You cannot love without giving. That's what love is. Love is an action. There's a book written by Bob Goff. It's called Love Does. And what does that mean? It means what it says. Love does. That's what love does. Love does things. Love is not an emotion. Love is not a fleeting feeling. Love is not butterflies in your stomach. Love is not infatuation. Love is not being desired. What love is love is an action. Love is something that you give. John 15, 13, Jesus says, greater love has no one than this, that someone lay down his life for his friends. How do I show love? Jesus just said, lay down your life. Romans 5:8, God shows his love for us in that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. How do I show love? You die to yourself. 1 John 4:10, in this is love. Not that we have loved God, but that he loved us and he sent his son to be the propitiation for our sins. You cannot serve and you cannot give without loving. If you want to be like Jesus, you have to love. And there is no greatness apart from love. There is no glory apart from love. You'll never experience the greatness and the glory that God has prepared for you unless you love. And here's something interesting too. As a side note, you will never experience love unless you love. And I said that last week, actually, by the way. And I want to keep driving this idea home, and we're going to preach on this a lot this next year. You can't experience love without loving someone. If you want to feel love, you need to serve. If you want to feel love, you need to give, because that's where greatness is. That's what love is. Love is not receiving. Love is giving, and love is serving. Love is an action. Love does. And so if you want to be great, you've got to serve, but you can't serve and you can't give without love, because that's what love actually is. And loving and giving and serving, here's what it's going to take. It's going to cost you. Loving and giving and serving is going to cost you. Well, what's it going to cost me? Time? Money? Energy? A Saturday? Gas, food, drink, clothing? Loving is going to cost you something. But in the cost of love, because love always has a cost, in the cost, there is great reward. And in that cost, there is great greatness. And there is glory that is brought to the one it's due when you truly love. Whatever love and serving and giving, whatever it costs you, I promise you it's worth it. Because whatever valuable thing that you give up to serve and to follow Jesus, I promise you, he will place something more valuable in your hands. And we said that last week. Whatever you give up for the cause of the gospel, whatever you give up for Jesus Christ, whatever you give up for somebody that you love, I promise you, something invaluable will be placed in your hands. You might say, but my time is so valuable. My resources are so valuable. My energy is so valuable. But if you give it up for Jesus and those you love, what you will receive will not be valuable. It will be invaluable. So what should I do? You should serve. Here's the only plug I'll make about this church, but you should serve at Fellowship Church. If this is your church, you need to serve because, as I said earlier, if you're saved, you serve. We're not consumers. Everyone contributes to kingdom growth with time, treasure, and talent. We have an amazing volunteer coordinator at Fellowship Church. It's Paula Lehman, and she's going to be hanging out at the info booth with me after our service, and this is not a shameless plug. This is a serve plug. If you want to serve, talk to her about how you can serve. You mean how I can serve the pastor and the church? No, no, no. How you can serve Jesus, and we'll show you ways you can serve outside of this church. Serving inside of the church is pretty cool, but it's just as important to serve outside of the church as well. You need to serve, because if you're saved, you serve. Help a neighbor move. Cook someone who's suffering a meal. Coach a kid's team. Be somebody's mentor. Find a community nonprofit to volunteer at. Whatever you do, serve. Because serving is where you find true greatness. Serving is where you find true fulfillment. Serving is where you find purpose. Serving is where you live the most like Christ. Serving is where you walk in His best for your life. Some of my best times in life and my best memories are revolving around this idea of serving. And it's because there's nothing more fulfilling. Even though I love to get, how many of you love to get stuff? I love to get. I love to be served. But it doesn't bring as much fulfillment as serving does. So the Son of Man didn't come to be served, but He came to serve and to give His life as a ransom for many. So look for ways to serve. And here's the conclusion of that idea. Cool, I'd love to serve. I'm saved, and so I know I'm called to serve. But Pastor, you don't understand. I don't have the time. I don't have time to serve. I don't have time to serve. I want to let you in on a secret. Do you know that you have just as much time as everybody else who's ever walked the face of this earth? Everybody has 24 hours a day. Everybody has 60 minutes inside of each of those 24 hours. Everybody has 60 seconds inside of that 1 minute that if you multiply by 60 equals an hour, and if you multiply by 24 equals a day. Everybody has 365 days a year. Everyone has 12 hours of daylight and 12 hours of darkness. You have the same amount of time as everyone else. And here's what you need to know, because you might not be able to do everything because of the place you are in life, but here's what I can promise you, is that God has given you exactly what you need to serve Him in the way He's called you to serve Him. God has given you the exact measure of time that you need to be able to serve Him. God has given you the exact measure of gifts and grace that you need to be able to serve Him. And sometimes I try to tell myself that I don't have time as I am browsing through Facebook, and I might have started at 12:05 and I thought I was on there for 2 minutes, and I look a minute later and it's actually 1:05. I might pick up a video game controller and think, I don't have time to serve, and I'm going to just play this game for 15 minutes, and you look at your clock, and whoa, 3 hours has passed. I just want to watch this 30-minute show on Netflix, but just another, and just another, and just another, and just another, and it's 4 a.m, and you've got to get up in 2 hours to go to work. We all have the same amount of time. We all have the gifts that are needed to perform the service that God has called us to do. So I would encourage you, realign your life with that of the will of God. Make God first in your life. Be willing to give up anything in order to follow God anywhere. And be willing to give up even your time, and be willing to give up your talent, because that's why God gave it to you. And that's going to take some shuffling. It's going to take some rearranging. It's going to take some reprioritizing, but I promise you it will be worth it. How much time is it going to take you to do X, Y, Z? Look at it. Put it in your calendar. Look at your calendar today. Figure out where you have time, where you have margin to serve. And I guarantee you that most of your margin is filled up with meaningless things. So you want to be great? It's not going to be found through a promotion, a raise. It's not going to be found through any position of authority. If you want to be great, serve. That's what Jesus says. Want to be great? Serve. 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 Jesus, I want to be great. Make me great. Oh, you don't know what you're asking. If you want to be great, serve. That's why I'm here. So if you want to be like God, love people, give, and serve, because that's where you will find greatness. Would you bow your heads? As your heads are bowed, I'm just asking you to do this so you can have a time of contemplation with no distraction. Preaching topically is pretty easy for me. Like, let's talk about a subject. And I could do that all day long. But it's kind of hard to actually just stick to the Bible and teach this, because you can't really add anything better than what Jesus has already said here. And I was like, God, what do you want me to do with this text? It's so self-explanatory. Want to be great? Serve. And if you had to say, Pastor, what's your point in this message? I got to say, man, I don't have one. I don't have a point. What's the one point? I don't know. All I know is that Jesus spoke it. The words of Jesus. Whoever wants to be great, serve. Whoever wants to be first, serve. I came not to be served, but to serve and to give. Serving and giving, that is how you show love. So I don't know what God's doing in your heart. I know God did some great things in people's hearts last week as we talked about giving up stuff to follow Jesus. But I would just ask you to ask God, what do you want me to know from your word here? Not what do I need to learn from Pastor Anthony, but God, what do you want me to know from your word? Where is there something in my life that I am being called to serve in? And I guarantee you this, serving is not easy. James and John, they thought it'd be easy. It's not easy. Serving requires suffering. And so if you think that God's put it on your heart, like, how can I serve? Well, I think the Lord wants me to go to Hawaii and to buy a $5 lei and to put it on someone's neck as they walk off the airplane, and I will get my serving in while I'm vacationing. Let's just say that's not serving. It's not. That's why I shared the story before. Like, why was I bringing the cooler out to those prisoners that day? Because I was dumb. And I thought that I would be great for doing it. But it wasn't about me. It was about serving. And I believe that if I would have went with a clear servant's heart to really serve and to love and to give to those prisoners, I think I'd still have that cooler today. I don't think it would have broke. I think God taught me a great lesson. It's not about you. It's not about you. It's about loving and giving and serving. And it's about sacrifice, suffering, and humility. So where do you need to serve? And many of you know the answer already.